Good afternoon to all of you, those who are watching online. I guess I should say, Feliz Sábado, mi amigo Miguel y Nomi. So I hope they're watching, and they'll probably evaluate my Spanish as well. Anyway, it's good to be here with all of you. We're very, very happy to be here in Los Angeles. I'm one of those rare people from Texas that wants to come to California, as opposed to the opposite, which is happens quite a bit. But we are very happy to be here. We're looking forward to spending time with the Carters, of course, and to see all of you today and then on the Holy Day as well. So it really is great to be here. I thought I'd comment a little bit on some of the things. I'm not correcting things that Mr. Frank said. So I do that once in a while. Of course, he does it to me too. But seriously, the well project that he talked about in Zimbabwe, Tanya, if you're one of those that do watch Intercord, you know that we were in Africa for 3 weeks in July, and that well project, the way that came about, the church and FOI helped with some of the funds for the building. They built a church building out in a remote area in Zimbabwe. It's called Gokwe. It's a region of Zimbabwe where there are a number of church members. And I've been amazed, frankly, over the years how sometimes in some developing countries, you know, you can have a capital city and another large city, and you think, well, God's going to call people in those big cities. And he does a few. But then, lo and behold, you know, there's a group of 50, 80, 100 people way out in the middle of what we would call nowhere. and I mean, it's happened many times over the years. In any event, this group in Gokwe have been a part of the church, some of them for a long time, and I'm giving you more history than you want to know. But actually, the kind of the patriarch of the group, it's not one family, but one particular family is the core numbers that make up that group in Gokwe. He since has died, but he actually received literature from Pasadena years ago, unbeknownst to any organized church that we had in that country at the time, 35, 45 years ago. And you find that happening every once in a while, particularly in some developing countries. I know that Mr. Tim Waddle, some of you know who Tim is, he actually takes care of our congregations in Kenya and East Africa. Just this past week, Tim went and followed up on a request for visit of a group of about 60 people in Uganda. Now, if you know where Uganda is, it's right down the street from San Gabriel and Duarte. No, just kidding. I mean, it's right next to Kenya. And anyway, he had communicated with this group. They had they actually were a part of the Worldwide Church of God at one time. That's how far back they grow. And they have been on their own. I'm obviously, when I say I'm oversimplifying it, that's what I know, but I know it's a bit oversimplified because, after 25 years, people have their bumps and grinds, you know, in surviving the world we live in. But anyway, he and some of the people that are attending with this group are new by our definition. It's interesting when you ask somebody, are you new to the church? Oh, no, I've been coming for 5 years. Well, we think, no. If you've not been in the church for at least 25 years, you're new. But anyway, so some of the people in this group in Uganda are new by our standards, I guess you could say. But Tim, I talked to him actually the other day. Some of you know what WhatsApp is? WhatsApp, I don't work for them, but it's a good app for your phone in that you can actually talk. As long as you have Wi-Fi and that other party does, doesn't matter where they are on planet Earth, you can talk with them. And I do talk to some of our elders in Africa that way because they will have what we call 4G, or they may not have Wi-Fi in their home. None of them do, but the type of cell service they have. Anyway, I called Tim the other morning. Actually, it was the morning that I left to come here to California, and we talked about the visit he had, and it really went very well. He said it's interesting, you know, when a group is kind of cut off from the main body of the church for years, music has a way of kind of defining a group in Africa. The music is a big deal, and it is this country, but there it is for a lot of reasons. He said there's some kind of some edges into the way they handle services. He was there as a guest. He wasn't there to at their request, but it went well. So I'm talking about the group in Uganda. I should be talking about the group in Zimbabwe. But Tanya and I went out to Gokwe. It was about a six-hour drive out there on the Sabbath that we went in July. It was the longest Sabbath I think I've ever had. Left at 4:30 and got back at 8:30 at night for one visit and service. But it was well worth it. It went well. And here they have all of this a small bit of acreage, built a couple of small buildings that Mr. Shabalala, he's the elder who lives 6 hours away, that comes every 6 or 8 weeks to care for them and speak and whatnot, for him to stay in. But he was telling me that they were digging a well by hand. And you may think, well, is the water table 10 feet down? No, no, no. It's 60, 70 feet. And I said, normally you'd think we would communicate about these things. But anyway, I said, well, Stephen, how much would it cost to get a professional driller to? He mentioned, I don't know, several thousand dollars, but $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. And I thought to myself, I can't speak for the church necessarily, but I said, I'm sure we can take care of that. You don't need to do that. And he said, really? I said, well, look, the building and other things. He said, no, I know. We just didn't want to ask for more. So when I got back from the trip, and also power, they don't have any power out there. And many of these developing countries are looking more to solar panels and power than they are using a small generator, which is the normal way they will do that. Because their need for kilowatt hours, for those of you who are electricians, is pretty low. And so, some solar panels in Africa can work very well for them. So I said, look, I'm sure somehow we meaning the church or FOI or some combination thereof, could get you a generator. That's not a hard thing to do. Long story short, they opted for the solar panels, and as soon as I got back, of course, Mr. Franks, because of the funds in the international fund and otherwise, said, look, if FOI can't do it, we'll take care of it straight away so that they can have this for the feast. Well, it took a few weeks to there was a donor that wanted to contribute to take care of it to FOI. And so long story short, that's what's happened. The money was wired. Some of these countries in Africa, you can wire it. And, of course, you know what wiring money is. You can, in the U.S., you can wire it and have access to it, a couple hours later. There, if you get it at all, it's maybe 4 or 5 days later or longer. So they had to wait a few days, but they did get it. Stephen got a hold of me just a couple of days ago with Stephen Shabalala, and they're just excited. They're hoping it gets done by the feast. And it probably will, but if not, these brethren meet there every Sabbath as well, although brethren from other areas in Zimbabwe come there for the feast. And so anyway, that's the other side of the story on that. But it's I think sometimes it's important to get the background of some of these things. Many of us in this room have been in the church a long time, and the church has made efforts to maybe leverage a nonprofit within the church to be able to help brethren, as well as to be a light in the community where that is appropriate. And I think that it is. But really the things that are being done for these young people, for scholarships, it's just huge. In the U.S., I realize that we have access to public education, but the way things are going in the public education field, you question whether or not that's the best option in some cases. That's another story or another topic. But as these other countries, other than going to, even if you're living in a rural area, other than going to school for until you're 10 years old, 9 years old, and you get a very basic education, some exposure to English in most of these countries, that's it after that. Unless you can pay to go to a little private school, you don't have any further education. And so, to have these young people who basically are teenagers to be able to finish either secondary school or in a few cases go to what we would call as college or university for a couple of years is just huge to them. It is just huge. And so those members who have contributed and others to the scholarship program, it is money well spent. And, this year when we were in I will have a sermon, by the way. It's coming. I've just got to share a few of these things with you. When we were in Zambia for the English classes, which is part of that same 3-week trip we took, there's a local rural school in Mapoko. This is where the congregation meets, and I've been out there a number of times over the years. And the rural school is that. It is a rural school, and it has windows with no glass in the windows. It's just a very basic thing, and it kind of fits what I mentioned a few moments ago. Give you an example there. I don't know how many students, Tanya, are in that school. I think 300 or 400 students. Two teachers. Because they have to have housing for the teachers and they have to commit for 2 years to teach in these rural areas. We think we have problems if somebody doesn't want to go to Bakersfield, you know, to be a teacher, if you see my point. There, it's a huge problem, just having people who are willing to educate on that level. But because we become a big fish in a small pond, if you understand the metaphor, when we show up there, because we are Mzungus, we're whites that show up in a black community, an African community, and they don't see hardly ever anyone from the western side of the planet. They just don't. In the capital cities, of course, they do. And so, so what we did 2-3 years ago, which was the last time we had the English classes due to the pandemic, and then what we did this year is offered the school a program of an hour and a half of a presentation and hearing from some of our volunteers who went. And those volunteers, one of whom was the Carter's son, Kevin, I asked them, they had enough to prepare for going over to Africa and teaching. They were very busy for the days they were held classes, and they did a wonderful job. But we had them ask if they would be willing to talk for 10 or 15 minutes each to these young teenagers, just about, you know, some of the choices in their life and how important education is. A pretty simple message, but they all had a slightly different story to tell. And they did a great job. They really did. And then I ended up having about a 20-minute presentation just on the importance of the choices you make as a young person, and told a story about a young man in Malawi, not in the church. A book was written about him. Anyway, you know, I'm not going to tell you about all that. But and it was the school, the headmaster at the school. I mean, you know, based on the things that all of us have done in the church. We're talking about Sabbath services, holy days, spokesmen's clubs, all kinds of different things that we do and sponsor and that many of you have been involved in. We may think, well, you know, an hour program, an hour and 20-minute program with 10-minute talks and a 20-minute presentation is not a big deal, you know. But it is a big deal there in that rural area, in that school, that we're there. And we do really want to leave a good impression. And we tried to leave them without directly preaching from the scripture, although you can mention the Bible in that school there, you won't get in trouble. You know what I'm saying? We knew that ahead of time. And I did. I turned to a few scriptures, in fact. But the point was, because we come into that community and we only work with the brethren on these English classes, we just felt it would be a good idea to leave a good impression in terms of what our heart and our motives are. And to give them some hope, because anything that these young volunteers presented and the things that I shared with them are all based upon what you and I believe about life, about what makes life work in the future, in fact. I didn't talk about the return of Christ and the end of the age, but I did talk about, you know, living in a troubled world and that there are better days ahead, and what's going to make them better is by people making choices in their life. Obviously, a handful of children in a remote African community isn't going to change the world. But I think all of us understand the bigger story that we know the Feast of Tabernacles is really a part of helping to remind us of. So anyway, just so that you know, any donations you make or you're just praying about FOI, it's not for nothing. There's, I think, some good things being done, and it surely does give an opportunity to some of our young adults who have volunteered to serve in that capacity, because those chances to travel and to be with brethren and to serve them it can be life-changing. It really can in a very good way. I think any of you in the church who have traveled and interacted with other brethren, you know what I mean. Okay, now I've got to get to a sermon. Oh, I wanted to mention a few other things, though. The weather, not L.A.'s weather, but in the Atlantic and in the Caribbean. Hurricane or Tropical Storm Ian, some of you who aren't weather aficionados may not be aware of it, but it's hurricane season. We've not had much activity. There is a tropical storm that was just named a couple of days ago called Ian. We're all used to these storms. And it is projected to ramp up to at least a Category 3 hurricane and brush the western side of Cuba and then make landfall on the western shore of the state of Florida by next Thursday. And of course, as the old if you, again, you follow these things, that there's a cone of reliability, and the further you get down the road, they can't predict exactly if this hurricane is going to go 100 miles to the right or to the left, and so it could end up getting closer to where Orange Beach is for the feast. We do have a feast site, a smaller feast site in Fort Myers, Florida, and that's kind of in the right in the bullseye right now. The storm is predicted to, you know, race across the state of Florida and go up the coastline of Georgia and South Carolina, and so we've got the feast site in Greenville, South Carolina as well, even though it would probably be downgraded a lot. So something to be praying about over the next week, as if you don't have enough to pray about, but not only for the safety of our brethren in those areas, because whether the feast or not, you know, the safety of God's people is a really important thing, as well as the feast site itself. I know Phil Sandilands, after the experience some years ago, he's kind of gun-shy when it comes. I mean, if he hears of a tropical depression off the coast of Africa, he's already worried about it coming. That's just the way it is, and that's where they start. It is true. But anyway, I think Tucson's safe from this hurricane. I really do. But please be remembering that in your prayers in the days ahead, because it's a very important part of what we are all preparing for. So, Steve, could I have a picture? No, that's not. There it is. Okay. So, how many of you know what this is? Some of you who know where I'm going with this probably, but others of you, how many of you know what is in the pot? Can you see what's in that pot? How do you say frog in Spanish?
Sapo.
Sapo? Okay. Okay. So we have the sapo in the pot, okay? So it is a frog in a pot. Now, there's an old wives' tale. For some of you who haven't heard this, some of you have, of course. There's an old wives' tale that says if you put a frog into a pot of cold water, it's cold, and then you turn the heat up slowly, that frog will remain in the water, in the pot, until it gets so hot that it's boiling and it cooks the frog. So I'm not promoting eating frog. This is not a sermon on clean and unclean meats. This old wives' tale sets that. You know, you put the frog in, you slowly turn the heat up, and the frog remains in the pot. Actually, this old wives' tale has been proven to be not true. I know had I heard of this wives' tale when I was a 12-year-old boy, I guarantee you I would have tried it. That's just the nature of 12-year-old boys, you know. But I hadn't, so it wasn't something I heard then. But, yeah, if you go online, and I've read a few articles about that, it's kind of a funny thing, but because I thought, well, it sounds plausible. And I'm sure there are a few frogs who have stayed in the pot, but there's no guarantee that that's the case. However, some of you may be wondering, well, what's the point? The story is often used, this particular wives' tale, the story is often used to illustrate how people have to be careful about slowly changing trends around them that they live in, their world, not just the sudden changes that take place. It's a warning to encourage people to pay attention not just to the obvious threats and influences, but to the subtle, more slowly developing threats in the world that they live in. So you can apply that to many things. So when you see the frog in the pot, think about that when somebody refers to a frog in the pot. That's what they're talking about. So but such a depiction, really, when you think about it, should serve as a warning to all of us. You know, when you describe this wives' tale is about, what the point is, many of us think about, okay, I think I understand. We've all got to be very careful about the impact that the world around us has upon all of us in the church, because we are living in perilous and troubling times. I'd like you to turn to John 17, if you would. John chapter 17. You can take Mr. Frog down anytime now, I'm sure. Of course, that may be easier to look at than me, but anyway. John 17. I think all of us know that John chapter 17 is the account of Jesus speaking to his Father on the night of the Passover in 31 A.D., and we read from John 17 each year at the Passover. And we know that all of the words contained in John 17 fundamentally speak to what Christ said to the Father. And when you go through this particular chapter, you realize that Christ is speaking about the church. He's praying for the church. and by extension, not just those a few men and ultimately several dozen people that several weeks later were received God's Spirit, but for those people who would believe on Christ through their word. But let's read John 17, verse 11. So we think about the frog in the pot. We're in the world. We got to be careful about the impact that it has on us. John 17, verse 11. Christ said, "Now I am no longer in the world, but these," speaking about the church, speaking about those that God had called, "are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are." So we know that he talked about the importance of the oneness of the church. Well, that's not the subject of this sermon. That's an important one that the church has struggled with, quite honestly, for 2,000 years, I would assume. But it's not one that we can't address, I don't believe. But that, as I said, that is a slightly different topic. But verse 14, Christ continues, "I have given them your word," that is to the disciples, "and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." But notice what he says here. "I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." So Christ really addresses this topic of being in the world. He even mentioned here that, look, he wasn't asking the Father to take the church out of the world. You know, there have been those who have assumed that that's true. You know, I've known of individuals and even small groups of people who have felt that God would want us to be separate from the world to the extent that they buy property in some remote place in the U.S. and dozens of people and families move there to get away from the world and to, to have this synergy of God's people being together. It all sounds good. And I'm certainly not suggesting that if a few people do that, family, extended family, fine. But that's really not what Christ was saying. He said, "I don't pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one." So being in the world but not of the world is a challenging thing. It obviously was at the time of Jesus Christ, and that hasn't changed in 2,000 years. And I'd submit that it's actually become more challenging, more difficult, as has been inferred already today, in the world that we live in. It really is. And it seems like every time that we have contact with people outside the church, and that's not with about everybody. I don't mean to say that, but you know, when you're out in the public setting, whether it's restaurants or whatever, you realize, or watching television, how things are changing, and they really are dramatically. And of course, the question is whether or not it affects all of us or how much it does. You know, recently we hosted a Young Adults Leadership Weekend, and I don't know if anyone from here was there. I know the Carters were involved, but we had it around the state, U.S., and this was actually the theme of that weekend. You know, being in the world but not of the world, and the subtitle was Navigating Satan's Alternate Universe. I thought that was a very appropriate subtitle for it. Navigating, that means, you know, finding the right way in your journey, it says Satan's alternate universe. In other words, there's and I think it's well stated. You know, we live in a world that is being defined culturally, morally, and otherwise, not by you and I and what we believe, but by a being that is influencing virtually every aspect of society, and professionals, CEOs, sports organizations are following down that road, generally speaking, and it's becoming the rule rather than the exception. And I don't want to get into all of those things specifically, but I think it's important for us to recognize this is not a new topic, though. It's not new. The level of its impact upon the society that we live in and the church may seem to be so, but it really isn't new. In Genesis chapter 6, we know that this is the account in the Old Testament where the flood is addressed. And, when you read through the flood account, you read that when things go bad with human beings, they can go real bad quickly. And I've read through, like many of you have, I've read through the account in Genesis 6 about the pre-flood world and what the account says. And it sounds, every time I read it, it reads surreal, as if, well, I know it had to be bad, but how bad, was it that bad? You know, and we'll read from that a little bit later. obviously, from God's perspective, it was horrific to the extent, of course, this is a quote from verse 5 of Genesis 6. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it grieved him to his heart. Another important statement. God was grieved by what he saw man was doing to himself. And at that point in time in the plan of God, he made the decision to only save those few, Noah and his family, and the others died. And, again, we know the story. The threat of being drawn in by the world's chaos has been around for hundreds of years. It existed in the very first 1,000 years, because that's about what it was, mankind being on earth. And we know that on another occasion, God confused the languages to slow things down. And yet we know, based on our understanding of the plan of God, that what we're approaching, based on what we see in Scripture as well as what we see in the world, is that period of time when God will intervene again. But on this occasion, that's upcoming, that we'll hear about even more on Monday. On this occasion, God is not going to stop mankind from he will stop mankind from totally destroying himself, but he's not going to stop the process and start over with this world. There's a new age that's coming. You'll start with some people from this age, and it's a very complicated, detailed plan that all of us know pretty well. But again, approaching that, what is the threat to all of us as God's people? In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, here we find the Apostle Paul writing to the church at Corinth, and I'm sure that all of you or many of you are aware of the history of the city of Corinth. It's not a good history. Corinth was built and was destroyed and rebuilt around, I think it was 100 B.C., and it became a Roman provincial headquarters for the Roman government. But because of where Corinth is on the Peloponnesian Peninsula, and the fact that it, because of east-west and north-south trade routes on the Adriatic Sea and other, it became the residence of a lot of people from all over the empire. And if you go, and I'm not suggesting you get out your tablet right now and do it, but if you go to Google and you actually, if you type in Corinthianize, that word, Corinthianize, you'll pop up Webster's Dictionary and a few others, and it will say, it will explain that to Corinthianize is a term that means to live a very morally compromising lifestyle. So even history has made that connection. So that being said, God called people out of that society. And as I implied a little bit ago, you know, it's amazing God's choice of where and from whence he calls people into the church. I don't consider God my calling. Well, I consider my calling to be a miracle knowing me, you know. But you know, some people have some incredible stories about how God called them into the church when he first started working with them. And I'm sure some of these people in the church in Corinth will have some amazing stories to tell about the life that they came from. And the cesspool, as it were, that they were living in, you know, when God called them. So that said, 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. So he's writing to the church. Verse 14, he says, "Be you not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." You read 1 Corinthians, you know that there were some problems in the church. They were allowing certain moral lifestyles to be allowed, where people were attending. In one case, it was a young man who was having an immoral relationship with his stepmother. Was a bad deal. And again, I know that you're aware of it. But he says here, we shouldn't become unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what concord has Christ with Baal? Or what part has he that believes with an infidel or an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate. So he makes his statement here to the church. He says, you need to come out from among them and be separate. Now, You remember what Christ said in John 17. He said to the Father, I don't pray that you take them out of the world and put them in some remote compound somewhere. And yet, Paul is admonishing the church of the care they need to take in terms of their relationships. And touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons, says the Lord Almighty. So, you know, it was true 5,000 years ago at the time of the flood. It was true 2,000 years ago when this was written, and it's true today. You know, as we begin the fall holy day season, given the meaning and the symbolism of the Feast of Trumpets coming up in just a couple of days, followed by the Day of Atonement in its meaning, and the Feast of Tabernacles, I think it's important that we talk about the times that we're living in and the impact it can have upon us in the church and the importance of us to remain untainted. I mean, we live in the world. And as Mr. Franks is even alluding to, you know, we still need to be a positive light in this world. And how we go about being that, of course, may seem to be challenging, but we should. And yet realize that this darkened world around us can have a negative impact on us if we're not careful. But what does it mean to come out? The Greek term that's actually used here in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 means to get out, to depart, to escape. So it really means to not let it have an impact upon us. Back in John 17, I won't ask you to turn there, but I'll just read what I did a few moments ago in verse 15. But what does it mean when Christ said, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one? Because Christ knew that the evil one, referring to Satan, has an impact and wants to have an impact upon your life. And, you know, I mean, and a negative impact upon your life. It's one thing to consider Satan's impact and his influence upon the church as a whole. Because, okay, yeah, he wants to destroy the church. But how does that happen? I mean, how is it that he would choose to have a negative impact on the existence of and the health of this church? I say this church meaning from his perspective. Now, the group of people, however God views that, that represent his called out ones, the body of Christ, his elect, how would he go about doing that? How would Satan go about doing that? I don't claim to know all of his devices, but there's no doubt in my mind that he is going to, more probably as much as anything, try to impact each one of us. Each one of us. He knows us. Satan does. He knows us. He knows. I don't know how he goes about figuring all these things out, but he does. And I'm sure he knows our weaknesses. He knows our strengths. And he wants to impact us. And, of course, I think he can passively, if you know what I mean by passively, impact us by having the world around us, you know, if you put it in a, you know, kind of a swimming parlance, the waters that you and I swim in every day, that can have an impact upon us. It may be indirectly, but it's because of what we see going on around us. And think of the frog in the pot. Think of the frog in the pot. So to be separate, what does that mean? How does that look in the life of all of us as Christians? I think it's pretty obvious that God led the Apostle Paul to draw upon the prophecies of Isaiah, because in 2 Corinthians 6, Paul is actually quoting from Isaiah, because they still directly apply to our lives today as they did with ancient Israel. So the remaining time of the message today, and I don't think I started preaching this sermon until about 3:15, was it? No, I'm not. I don't want to squeeze more time. I just didn't want to have you think, wait a minute, you were introduced right at 3 o'clock, and so you're going to have to quit before 3. Well, it may be a few minutes after, only because I rambled on about other things first. But I want to leave you with two pieces of input, two pieces of advice regarding this subject, the remaining time. Number one, this is something we've already started addressing, and it's this first point is something that I think many of you already have been doing. Now, how you go about and I go about doing this is another matter, but I think many of you have already started doing this number one thing, or this first thing I want to mention. And that's the importance of us understanding the world that we live in for what it really is. an awareness of what's going on in this world. So I don't think that's new revelation to any of you. You're not going to write it down and say, you know, I never thought of that. I suspect all of us have, to one degree or another. As I said a few moments, you need to understand, I need to understand, and again, it's a metaphor, the waters that we're really swimming in every day and the impact that can have upon us. Sometimes we can be oblivious to what lies beneath the surface of the water because we sometimes only see what's on top. Kind of reminds me of several years ago when I was younger but also had the opportunity of serving at the Teton Challenger Camp up in Wyoming. These were in the United Church of God days, but some of you may recall we had a camp that was for older teens and even some younger young adults, and it was a 10-day program in the wilderness of the Tetons, and I taught paddling or canoeing, and so because we weren't paddling on a 2-acre lake, you know, or a 5-acre flatwater lake, it was on the Snake River, and that river is named for a purpose, not because it's teeming with snakes. It's because of the circuitous route that it takes through the mountains and the valleys in that part of the world. And, of course, so this was 19 years ago, I think the last time I took a lifeguarding class. You may be laughing, well, what were you doing taking a lifeguarding class at age 51, which was when I was 19 years ago. Well, it was the third time I had gotten certified for life to be a lifeguard. And because at the time, we had to be sure that all of our activity heads were qualified through training. And, of course, we still do that today at our camps. But at the time, we were trying to be accredited by the American Camping Association. And so, but it was good practice, I think, very good practice to do that. But I'll tell you, some of you probably have been lifeguards. You got your lifeguard training at some point in time. It was probably when you were younger. And when I went to, so this was in Richardson, Texas, so I went to YMCA, I'd signed up for it, and of course I show up, and you know, you got to show up and you got to have your swimming trunks on, and of course I had a t-shirt on as well at that point in time. I had no six-pack to show off. The only one I had was in my refrigerator back home, and I wasn't showing that off at the time. So yeah, some of the young people there thought, well, you must be the instructor. No, I'm not. But the point I'm making in all of this is I ended up also doing some whitewater rescue classes. I just to get exposed to that. Why? Because when you're paddling on a river with the volume of the Snake River and you're dealing with probably 10 or 12 canoes going down a river that at times is moving pretty swiftly, you have a bit of whitewater, not a lot of it, but a lot of other features. Sometimes you don't know what's under the surface of the water, even if it's moving swiftly. And so you have to anticipate that. And so with some of these campers who may not have had that experience, you have to talk to them. You have to take all of the precautions so that when they go around a turn in the river, there are what's called submerged trees. In fact, they're called strainers, and people have been killed because of that, because they don't know what's down there, and it can really the water going around it can really if you happen to capsize, you can suck you right under. It can be dangerous. We tried to make it not so, you know, so that it could be an enjoyable, and it generally was, but it just kind of illustrated to me back then, and I've thought of it since then, and there are many other settings one could make that in, and that is that you got to know what is underneath the surface. Sometimes things look okay. They look okay from the surface. And that's true even in the world we live in. You know, Tanya and I, the last day and a half, we visited the Gutierrez's yesterday for, what, 3 or 4 hours, had a wonderful time with them. But you drive around Southern California, and we've lived here a few times in the past, and if you get it on a day like we've had the last few days where you got the hot winds coming down the mountains and it's clear as a bell, And the greenery is actually green. It can be beautiful. I mean, it can. On the surface. And I'm not, that's true with any big city. And it can be. I mean, Southern California, there's a reason why it attracted so many people 150 years ago. There's a reason for it. We human beings, and it doesn't matter if it's L.A. or if it's Dallas or Chicago or New York or anything, we can kind of ruin that because of what happens as the years go on. And so it is, you know, with the world we live in. Things can look okay on the surface, and it's important that we understand the depth of the difficulties that this world we live in is presenting to us. The danger that it can be to the way that we think, our coworkers, neighbors, others. I realize that there are other people in this world that have no knowledge of God's truth that also are concerned. It's not as if we're the only ones. But sometimes it's important, I think, for us in the church to recognize that many people out there, and it's become politicized, unfortunately, these are moral problems and civilizational issues, but it's become so politicized that, and that's all that some people know as hope for them to address it. And that's the glasses through which they view all of this. You can't necessarily blame them because of the frustration that some people have about any number of issues that we would fundamentally probably agree with, such as abortion. And I mean, I could just go on and on, and I don't want to necessarily list those things at this point, take the time to do that, because I think many of you know that. But it's important that we recognize the importance of the impact these things can have on us. In Matthew 24, here we find Jesus speaking to the disciples on the Mount of Olives. This is referred to as the Olivet Prophecy, simply because Matthew's account, Luke's account, Luke 21, Mark has an account of this. He spoke to his disciples about the end of the age and his return. And he was asked the question, what's going to happen? How do we know? Now, these men who asked the question that you find Christ referring to or answering, responding to in Matthew 24, they didn't know at the time that what Christ was referring to, while it may have had a dual fulfillment, a bit of which took place some years later when the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem and all, but he was really referring to, in its ultimate fulfillment, something that was really about 2,000 years away. They didn't know that. So they're asking this question. He's responding to it. But notice what he says here in verse 24, or in verse 37, excuse me, of Matthew 24. And I want you to think about this in light of what we read in Genesis 6 and what we're talking about in the message. He said, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." And notice what he says here. "For as in the days of before the flood," so he's talking about those days prior to, you know, the bodies of water that burst forth from the deep, and all of the ways that God allowed the flood to take place. Just before that happened, he said, "They were eating." Now, who's the "they" that he's referring to? He's talking about people, everyone. "They were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark." What does that mean? What's that mean? All it means is that they were living life. They were living life. And which included eating meals, planning their future, getting married, as the case was. And whatever the moral conditions were in the world at that time, that was the new normal. And it was being embraced and accepted, and people were going with that flow. Verse 39, "and did not know," that is the "they" that's being referred to, "they did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." So he was telling them that life will seem normal. There will be probably a new normal that is redefined, right, wrong, family, any number of things. And people will be ignorant of the fact, because it's going to be shocking when the events that we know are really touched upon on Monday and the Feast of Trumpets will take place. Now, in Genesis 6, so I'm going to go back to Genesis 6. We commented on that a few moments ago. Genesis 6, verse 5. "Then the Lord saw," so I know we're going from Matthew back to Genesis now, but we're going to the flood account in Genesis 6. "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." That's a pretty pervasive statement there. Got a couple of lawyers here. Choose your words carefully when you're accusing somebody of something. Am I right? I mean, you do. You have to be careful. And obviously, even lawyers who are making their final arguments will try to appeal to the jury, sometimes to their emotions, and that's part of the deal. But what I'm making is that this is a very pervasive statement. Does that mean that every human being that was alive at the time of the flood, save Noah and his immediate family, had nothing but evil on their minds 24/7? Well, I don't think that it meant that, but it was close to that. You know, I mentioned a few moments ago, and all of you know this to be true, we live in a world where there are people who are extremely concerned about the direction not only of our country, but of the world, from a geopolitical perspective. And some of it kind of connects back to what we're talking about even in our country or even in Israelite nations that we know to be true today. But we read this here in Genesis 6, and then verse 6, "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart." Now, sometimes we can read this and think, you know, God said, I should not have done this. I shouldn't have created man. I blew it. I made a mistake. It's not what it says. He regretted what he saw mankind doing to himself. It wasn't as if it wasn't without precedent. On a spiritual level, there was great precedent. You read about that in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. When Lucifer, and you find that referenced prophetically in Revelation chapter 12, when a third of the stars of heaven fell. And Jesus even made a comment of what he saw about that. So this is not without precedent, even though he had created these beings in a physical level that we find referenced here in Genesis. So verse 7, the Lord said, "I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." Verse 13, "And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." Now, I think it's important to remember that the Genesis account is a historical, accurate historical reference to what took place. I don't believe in every case it's meant to explain the rationale behind everything. We have to piece that together as we understand the plan of God. But God was obviously very serious about the destructive impact of mankind upon each other. He was concerned about that. And that he would have to start over in terms of working with Noah and his family. And of course, then you've got all the animals that he brought onto the ark, because all the other animals were destroyed. He didn't accuse the animals of thinking evil, but he did destroy them, except for those that could genetically carry on the species that God created for mankind to have, or that God created for mankind to oversee on planet Earth. Luke 17. I'm going to read Luke's account. Luke's account of this comparison made from Noah's time to the time of the disciples at that point. Luke 17, verse 25. Luke 17, verse 25. So he's speaking here of Christ. We're breaking into a thought. "But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation." That was the generation that existed at the time of Christ's ministry. "And as it was in the days of Noah," so Luke brings up this comparison. Now, this wasn't in Luke's account of the Olivet prophecy. That's in chapter 21. But he nonetheless brings this up. "As it was in the days of Noah, so will it also be in the days of the Son of Man." And at verse 27, "They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." It shocked them, in other words. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. So he brings that up another comparison. We know what happened to the cities of the plain. You know, that's recorded in the latter part of the book of Genesis as well. And it says here, "Likewise, also the days of Lot." But on that, "They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. Life went on. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." Now, if you think about the account of Lot and his wife and leaving Sodom and Gomorrah and the challenge that they had. His wife turned back. She turned into a pillar of salt. Lot was not without his temptation and troubles. It is true that Peter made reference to him to be a man of righteousness, but in the end, he made the right choice. But there was an angel pulling him away. You go back and read that account. It wasn't easy for him. And I can't know, and none of us can know for sure why he struggled, except that he had family that made a different choice, his own wife. He lived in that same environment and was somewhat of a leader from what we can read in Sodom. And, you know, the negotiating that took place when these people of Sodom wanted to have what was really the angels to come out. I mean, it was just a horrific situation. But the point Christ is making here is there's going to be a sense of normalcy about life as there was in Sodom, as there was in Gomorrah, as there was at the time of Noah. It's going to be that way true today. There are many things we could talk about and did with the young adults a few weeks ago. And I will mention these briefly because rather than speaking to current issues themselves, these have more to do with philosophical approaches to life that we find extant today. Not with every one, but I think you'll get the picture as I go through this. One of them, materialism. Materialism. Materialism, of course, is the theory or doctrine that physical well-being and worldly possessions constitute the greatest good and the highest value in life. So people who embrace materialism, it's about having things. It's about having things. A desire. Now, the interesting thing is you have to have things to get along in this life. And if things amount to vehicle or vehicles, homes, other things. Now, there are things that aren't necessary for life that we can also have. So, you know, how many of us in this room have things? We all do. Some people in this room may have more things than others. Some of you may store things in your garage for the last 50 years, you know, and some may have some newer things. I mean, I'm not knocking things. I'm just bringing this up. We live in a world where materialism, particularly in Western society, embraces people on an incredible level. Sensualism. So these are isms that we're talking about. Sensualism, which means subjection to sensual appetites. We have different senses. The theory is that the highest good consists of sensual gratification. People want to gratify their senses. Of course, our venues of entertainment are literally filled with sensualism and convey the message that the ultimate human experience is sexual sensualism. That's usually what we think of when we think of sensualism, but it goes far beyond that. Satan knows, of course, how to wrap perversion and immorality in a very attractive package. He can do that. He's done it. And it surrounds us, and he uses it to lure people. It happens in some subtle ways and some not so subtle ways. From entertainment to watching NFL football and Monday Night Football and watching, who's it? What's her name that sings on Monday or Thursday Night Football? You can say it, sweetie. Carrie Underwood. Okay. Good voice. I guess my point is just, I say subtle, not so subtle, so this is not a rant against watching football on Thursday night. That's not what I'm saying, okay? All I'm saying is that it surrounds us in so many ways. And it's a part of the world that we live in, the Western world in particular. Voyeurism, this really sounds kind of bad, I know. But when you find out, which I dug down, as some of us did a little bit deeper on this, it's an obsessive observer of sordid or sensational subjects. That's what a voyeurist is. Enjoys seeing sensualized or sordid situations. Now, usually it's associated with a person who's viewing that in terms of sexual activity. And that obviously fits the bill there. But it also can mean taking pleasure in viewing behavior that is destructive. Violence, does that entertain today? Violence on any number of levels? I'll let you answer that question. Hedonism, H-E-D-O-N-S-I-S-M. The pursuit or devotion to pleasure, especially to the pleasures of the senses, kind of overlaps with some of these other isms. The philosophy, the ethical doctrine holding that only what is pleasant or has pleasant consequences is intrinsically good. There are those people who have, and philosophers who have taught that and believe that. Of course, pleasure, the kind of pleasure that's wholesome and is lasting and has meaning and purpose, should come as a result or a byproduct of doing what's right in life to help others. I mean, we all want to enjoy things. You know, God surely isn't against that. He created us with the ability to be, to have pleasure, enjoy pleasure, and to rejoice and to have joy. But again, we're talking here about the pursuit of it, of and by itself. Cynicism. Distrusting the motives of others. Is there any reason in the culture that we live in for any of us as American citizens to have any amount of distrust for other people? I know I speak as a fool when I ask the question. You know, distrust is something that happens. But I want us to think about, and I mean this sincerely, think about the impact of cynicism run amok and run wild, and the impact it has upon us as human beings, especially knowing the truth of God. We need to be smart and wise. There's no question about that fact. The disbelief in the sincerity of human motives. You know, I think of people in the world that we live in who have become addicted to political discourse. The nature of it, that it, as it exists in our culture, in our country, not our country only, and the growing cynicism towards authority on both sides of the aisle and towards any number of people and things. Now, you may think, well, what are you saying that these people we should blindly trust? No, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just saying that that's one of the things that define the culture that we live in, and it can have an incredibly dilatory impact upon us as Christians if we're not careful. God expects us to use wisdom and maturity and to take a step back, and if I can say this without sounding judgmental in a wrong way, above the fray of what's going on in this world and our society, and to make sound judgments on how we need to proceed as God's people with wisdom, discerning right and wrong, and not compromising that. Another, individualism. Of course, one of our former presidents talked about how this country was founded on rugged individualism. And it was. I think it was Ronald Reagan that I'm quoting. And there's truth to that. And there's some good that came from that on a human perspective, that of some of those individuals that actually had the fortitude and the strength to open new frontiers. I'm not talking about the political side of things, but in our country 150 years ago. But that's not really what I'm talking about. The doctrine that the interests of the individual should take precedent over the interests of the state or social group. That's what individualism preaches. And it's seen as the culture of self-interest. It's all about me. Who cares about anybody else? I just want to take care of myself. And when people are desperate in circumstances, that's what we human beings tend to do. I know of and have heard of people. Not talking about people in the church, although I wouldn't doubt there's a few who have gone to that extreme, sadly, but of people who are really building their own bunker at home with dried food. Nothing wrong with having dried food, but I think you know why I'm saying that. And ammunition and armaments, because they believe the day's coming when they're going to need that to survive. My wife and I were on our way to Louisiana last January, and of course, when I tell you why we were going there, you're going to say, really? I like to hunt animals that I can eat. That's all that I like to hunt. And I have for years. And so my wife, it took me 40 years to get her to want to go hunting. But anyway, she actually has. I bought her a rifle for hunting. It's not an AR-15. Please understand that. Lest anybody. Well, but that's the world we live in. And, you know, people. But what I'm saying, though, is that we were going over to in January to go camping we have a little pop-up camper, and to go deer hunting for a couple of days in Louisiana. I had a good time. But we stopped at a range to sight in the rifles, which you need to do to make sure that they're shooting accurately and safely. There was an old gentleman at this range, because we walked in. It was a cool morning, and I'd never been there before. And there's these gentlemen, probably all in their 60s, had camo on in this outbuilding. And they were just talking, and I come in with this young lady. With this young lady. Okay, I should say that. Anyway, and you're here to use the range? Yeah, we are. And, well, what do you do? Well, okay, I told him what I did. And we got to talking about kind of the world we live in a bit. I mean, I didn't bring it up. You didn't have to. These guys were all by best description, conservative, a couple of them ex-military. They're in their 60s. The one had a Bible open actually on the desk, and matter of fact, when they asked what I did a little bit later, I said, "Well, I work for a church. Actually, I've been a pastor." And, oh, you know. And then they said, "We gotta be careful what we say." You know how that goes. And, but the conversation was a conversation that if any of you listened, you'd think, "Okay, you know." I mean, it was fine. And because I told them when they said that, I said, "Well, yeah, one of you really impressed me with that open Bible when I walked in, because he was obviously had been reading it." But here's where I'm going with this. When I went back out to the vehicle after we had gone to the range and come back, and Tanya and I are walking back to the vehicle, he came up to me, this older gentleman, and he wanted to talk to me a little bit. He said, "You know, I told you in there I don't hunt anymore because I just you know, I've had my run at that. It's been fine." He said, "But I do own some firearms," and he said, "The reason I do," and he was dead serious when he was talking to me about this. He said, "The reason I do is because I'm worried about the country we live in. I think we're going to have civil war." And so that all of you know, during this conversation, there was nothing came up about Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any of that. None of that came. Not to say that they didn't have their feelings about it. That really wasn't. That was not the discussion. Because he said, "You know, I'm really worried that the world we live in is going in a wrong way, and this country is." And he said, "I want to take care of my wife and some of my neighbors who are handicapped." And he said, and he starts telling me about, you know, he says, I don't see a way forward, because if this world's going to get that bad, he said, "What do you think?" So I'm about ready to get in the vehicle. I kind of wanted to get out of there. I spent a few minutes talking to him, not that long. I said, "Well," I said, "I think there's two choices." Because he said something about God and what God would expect of us. You know, so he did bring that context. I said, that one of the two results, mankind is going, regardless of your efforts or anybody else's efforts to take care of themselves, I said, mankind's either going to destroy himself or God's going to have to intervene and save us from ourselves. I said, those are the two choices as I see it. And he just shook his head. Now, I mean, what credibility did I have? Except that the subject came up. And he said, "Look, I'm not a white supremacist." You know, he's trying to. I said, "I just am concerned about my family." Now, he lives obviously in rural northern Louisiana, and but he's pretty articulate. So you understand what I'm saying. Some of you do. So I mean, he's a pretty educated guy. But then he starts telling me, "Well, look, if you ever come through here again, here's my name, here's my phone number. You're welcome to stay with my wife and I, blah, blah, blah." Well, we haven't gone back to visit him, okay? But I don't think that's untypical, where I'm going with this, of some people in this country. They don't know what you know and what I know about the future. They don't fully grasp what we understand about human nature, even our own. They don't. And that's because God hasn't chosen yet to call them. It's not because I'm better than them. Or that we're except that God's invested something in you and in me that he hasn't yet totally invested, having yet called them, others. Some people see that the world and the country is a mess. They don't always understand why. their solutions sometimes are not real good. They can add to the confusion, but that's the nature of the world we live in. That's the waters that you and I are swimming in, brethren. And it's important for us to recognize that. Last point, and this will be short-lived, and that's the importance of remaining laser-focused on the outcome of where this is all going in terms of God's plan. To remain focused on that. It's extremely important. It's pretty timely to bring that up since the Feast of Tabernacles is right around the corner. God gives you and I a leg up, an opportunity to remain focused on the return of Jesus Christ, the establishment of his government and his family, and us being fortunate enough to be a part of that team of people to assist Jesus Christ in being able to do that. And many of the people that I've made reference to in the confusion that people have, and those by the millions that are really caught up in this perverted approach to reality in life, those people, many of those people will not live through the tribulation. There are those that will and that are going to need help. And we know that the Feast of Tabernacles and those days leading up to it, we focus on that. And it's important, feast or not. You know, your pastor, anybody could be giving a message similar to this in May, in February. It's important that we all remain laser focused on the outcome and where all this is leading. I mentioned earlier how the world views, you know, the problems in it through a certain lens. You know, that's the way they view it because they've not been called. They don't understand the truth of God. Well, we've got a particular way of being able to view the future and view the present in light of the future. It's important that we do that to understand the nature of the world around us and to stay laser focused on what's ahead. In 2 Peter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 2. And this is, I made reference to this a little bit ago. This is when the Apostle Peter made reference to Lot and said that Lot, despite the fact that he had some weaknesses or some shortcomings, was a righteous man. Notice verse 6. And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, this is what God did, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. So God wants us to remember what happened, especially when we're speaking about a topic like this, and delivered righteous Lot, so he makes reference to him being righteous here in verse 7, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. There's a lot in that statement. Lot, although he was righteous, was oppressed. He was affected by the wicked world that he lived in. It wasn't easy for him. I believe he was a conflicted man at times. I don't know to what extent, but I think he was conflicted because of what he lived in and the impact it had on people that he loved, quite frankly. Verse 8, parenthetically, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. It wasn't easy. It was tough. It was difficult. It's clear, though, that Lot's wife lost sight. You have to believe, at least I certainly would conclude that Lot's wife had some understanding of the truth. If her husband was considered righteous, Lot, I can't imagine that she was clueless as to what he believed, because maybe she believed that too or understood it. You know, we all are living a human life, a physical life, and it has its challenges. And God knows better than certainly I know about the challenges that everybody in this room faces and those even who are watching. We face them. Sometimes those challenges actually turn out to be a productive thing in our life, despite the fact that we do all we can to deal with it. That's part of the struggle, part of the decision-making that we go through and struggling with some of the trials we have is the positive outcome that can take place. You know, but we may wonder, how in the world can someone who has God's truth, you know, turn their back on that truth? It can happen. It can happen. It's a good question. But clearly Lot's wife is just one example, because Christ made the statement later in his ministry, remember Lot's wife. Don't forget that point. Don't forget it. To lose sight of the vision and the goal of the kingdom of God, of the return of Jesus Christ, of really the answer to man's problems. It's a complex answer, I would submit. It's simple in one sense, You know, we talk about, well, all of these problems. I've been to many a spokesman's club where somebody will ask a question, you know, well, how are we going to solve this problem in the world tomorrow? Well, we're going to solve this problem when Christ returns. It'll solve it. Well, it's true. But how? His return alone isn't going to solve the problem. It's what that implies and what's going to happen, what he's going to do, what the family of God is going to do. And that's what God wants us to be focused on in our lives, to be motivated by that. You know, having purpose in life, even as a Christian, is extremely important. If you don't, and if you or I lose sight of the purpose of our lives as it relates to God's calling, because those two should become one in time. You know, there are a lot of people who don't understand the truth of God who are advised by counselors and therapists, especially when they're suffering from clinical depression, of the importance of having purpose to their lives and meaning to their lives. Not because they understand the truth of God, and some people will try to formulate a purpose for their life on a physical plane, and it does help them. It does. It's proven. How much more so for those of us in the church of having a purpose in our lives? We know that that's important. We know. Revelation 18, I'll just make reference to this. We know that Jesus Christ and this message that he revealed to John talked about Babylon falling. Well, let's turn there, Revelation 18. Revelation 18, verses 1 through 5. So we'll be, I'm sure this, some of this will be touched upon, you know, on trumpets, but the point I'm making here as it relates to the topic that we're talking about. Verse 1, after these things, John says, I saw the other angel coming down from heaven having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven, verse 4, saying, Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. It speaks of a time when God is speaking to the nation of Israel. We believe that what is being referred to here is the and I say Israelites, but there's an application to spiritual Israel, the church. And we know that this Babylonish system, it's a very all-encompassing definition of a system, not only economically, but a way of thinking that's going to permeate the world. And I think what you and I see that concerns us on the horizon and even day-to-day sometimes in the world we live in is a direct link to that, brethren, a direct link. You know, the fall holy days do prefigure these days that we're talking about, the end of the age, the incarceration of Satan and his influence for a period of time, and the hope of a new world to solve many of the complex problems that we human beings have brought upon ourselves and will continue to do so. And we know a sobering decree by a member of God's family crying out to my people, the nation of Israel, is something that God wants us to remember. God does not want his people to suffer. He doesn't want his church to suffer, and he certainly doesn't want, you know, mankind to suffer, but he knows it's inevitable, particularly those who are not in the church. God wants his church and his people to succeed, and he wants us to know what is ahead. We need, brethren, to lock in our focus in the future and remember that we are sojourners waiting for another world, not waiting doing nothing, but responding to the challenges and some of the things we have in front of us as human beings, as members of the church. I'm going to end by reading from Hebrews chapter 11, and this will be the end of the sermon, by the way. Because Paul comments here in Hebrews chapter 11, we know this is often referred to as the faith chapter. He makes one very specific comment about the conviction and faith of our forefathers as it relates to this last point. And these clearly are servants that have come out of her already. It's clear by what we read and remain focused on the future. Let's read in conclusion Hebrews 11, verse 13. Hebrews 11, verse 13. Speaking of those examples of faith in verse 13, he says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth."